There is no more important question in all the world than the question of whether or not there is a God. There's no more important answer in all the world than the answer to that question. We as Christians, if you are a Christian here today, foundational to the ideas and assumptions of Christianity is the fact that behind it all, the bedrock foundation of it all, is God. And that there is a God, and that there's a loving God, creator of all the world, who has acted in history. This is something that's central to our belief. And for the vast majority of world history, it's an assumption that was held across cultures by the majority of people. It's something that is kind of, I guess, just a natural human belief that you see that people shared. Really, it's a relatively recent phenomenon that a large group of people or growing percentages of people have begun to reject this claim. I was asked, one of the things that I try to do, I try to plan out my lessons in advance, and sometimes I'll ask, people if they have topics or things like that that they'd want to cover. And one of the topics that I was asked that something that people might want to cover is the idea of doubts and reasons why we believe what we believe. And so we started a series last week looking at the topic of doubt, and last week we discussed doubt itself and some of the things that we can do about our doubts as the community of the people of God. But this week, we're going to talk about doubts, perhaps, that arise about God and why it is that we should feel confident in our belief in God. It's a completely irrationally justified position. You might be told that it's only for simpletons who haven't thought things through, but that's a foolish thing to be told. There are very good reasons to believe in God, and we'll talk about a couple of those. Next week, we'll talk about reasons not just for belief in God, but for belief in the truth of Christianity. And we'll talk about the resurrection of Jesus and a couple of other things. And then the final week, we'll talk about reasons that we should believe in the Word of God. Why is it that we should live our lives by a book that was written a really long time ago in a different language in a different part of the world by people we've never met? Why should I make sacrifices now because some ancient book tells me to? Well, there's some pretty good reasons. So we'll talk about some of those things as we go through this study. But to start off today, we're going to talk about why it is that we believe in God. And I'm not like a professional apologist. An apologist is someone who argues for the truth of Christianity. I'll just be honest with you. I believe in God for many, many reasons. And some of them would make terrible arguments for the existence of God. You know, some of them are completely subjective. I realize that. I have a bias in this thing, too. I love believing in God. I like the idea that God exists. I want there to be a God. Sometimes apologists try to start off by showing that, you know, they were brought dragging and kicking and screaming into belief in God only because of the evidence. I wasn't. I was told that there was a God from a young age. It's the bedrock of my marriage. It's the bedrock of my relationship with my family, with my church community. I would be absolutely devastated if there was no God. I like there being a God, and I want there to be a God. And so I'll just say that at the beginning. I'm not approaching this dispassionately. I'm approaching this as someone who loves God and wants there to be a God. I'm also approaching this as someone who believed in God long before I ever heard an argument for God's existence. I believed in God because I was told there was a God. And so my whole view of the world, like everything in the world, is shaped by this view that I've held for as long as I know. There's never a moment where I didn't believe in God. And so when I see mountains with respect to this belief in God that I have. And I thank God for mountains. It's like, it would be so weird for me to go through life and to try to do so without the realization that there is a creator. It's like my conscience bothers me all the time because I believe in a God. And what I mean by that is like, I even if you think you can get away with something, there's still overhanging you the fact that you can't get, you can't hide things from God. It's like my morals are grounded in the idea that there is a God. My appreciation of beauty is grounded in the idea that there is a God. My community is grounded in the fact that there is a God. My love for one another is, like, all of that stems from this. It's a foundational belief to all that I have. And I don't think that that's something to apologize for. I don't think that that's something I should try to say, no, I only believe in God because of the cold, hard evidence and all of that. That's not the case. I do think that there's evidence. I do think that it's a rationally justified belief by all means. But I also think that if you do believe in God, even if you've never studied apologetics, even if you've never studied arguments for the existence of God, your world will make sense to you. And I think that in and of itself, the fact that things all seem to come together around that belief, and that belief can ground your day-to-day life and all that you are. You can be thankful for the food you eat because you believe in God. You can appreciate beauty, not just for the thing itself, but for the artistry behind it because you believe in God. There's belief in God will, I believe, can give you a view of the world where things fit together well and make a whole lot of sense. And so if you feel that way, even if you've never studied apologetics, I think you are justified to continue believing in God. I think it makes a lot of sense for you to continue believing in God. But there are people who they don't believe, or there are people who they struggle with thinking that belief is entirely irrational. Like, I'll give you just a quick example of something. My prayer life. I believe that God answers prayers. My prayer life is one of the things that I think helps ground my faith in God. But at the same time, I think prayer makes a terrible argument for the existence of God. Like, I don't think I should use prayer to try to convince somebody that God exists. I'll give you a quick reason why. There are things in my life that I have prayed for, and they have happened. And I thank God for that. I believe that came from God. But could I in any way prove that had I not prayed, that would not have happened? Well, I can't prove that. I have no idea what would have happened had I not prayed. So it's not like you can prove. Or there are things that I've prayed for, and they have not happened. And I can say, oh, well, God answered that in an unexpected or different way. Or God answered that no, or something like that. But what other people could hear is, all right, all you're doing is you're saying God answered something even though you can't prove it. And then you're saying God said no, even though it's probably likely just there is no God. Like, I guess I would say subjectively, personally, prayer means a lot for my belief in God. But there are some things that can personally, for you as an individual, ground your belief in God, but they might not be convincing to other people. I say hold on to those things that are personally, subjectively convincing to you. But also recognize that there are objective reasons to believe in God. There are reasons that are beyond even just your personal experiences. And I think those are valuable too. Throughout the history of Christianity, these have been discussed. These have been discussed quite a bit. People have grounded their belief in God in logic, and in science, and in philosophy, and in a whole lot of things. In fact, if you were to look for arguments for God's existence, you can find quite a few throughout history. We're going to focus on just a very low number of them, and we're only going to sketch them because this is a huge topic that you could spend a lot of time on that we don't have that time. But I do want to talk a little bit about some of the arguments that have become very popular that are used today. And the reason they're popular and used today is because they're very powerful still. They've existed for a long time. They have been used and argued in different ways, and there's still arguments that people have a hard time being able to give any other explanation than the existence of God. One of those is called the cosmological argument. This argument, in essence, deals with the idea that things exist, and they didn't always exist. That didn't always exist is a crucial part of the argument. But things exist now. How did things come into being? How did the universe come into being? How can we give reasonable justification for our experiences and the fact that things do exist? The cosmological argument deals with that. Thomas Aquinas is a very well-known theologian, a Catholic theologian, who thought that he should be able to ground his beliefs in logic. And so he spent a lot of time trying to ground foundational beliefs of his, even like things like the belief in God, in logic and rationality. And he came up with a series of different types of what you could call cosmological arguments. And they all deal with the idea that an infinite regress of past events is impossible. What I mean by that is if you walk into a room and you see dominoes falling, you should think that there is a first domino that started falling. rather than dominoes have just been falling on an infinite line going, you know, on forever and ever and ever, and there was never a first domino. He thinks that that's an absurd idea. I tend to agree with him on that. I think you can find good reasons to deny the reality of an infinite number of past events. There are philosophical reasons, basically, that deal with the fact that an absolute, true, infinite number of things is not a possibility. Everything is finite. Really quick example, you can go into it a whole lot further, but just think about, let's pretend, I know this isn't the case that's made by atheists, but let's just pretend our solar system, for example, has existed for an infinite, just infinity past. Think for a moment about how long it takes for the Earth to make its way around the sun. About a year, right? That's why we have years. So about 1 year for us to do that. How long does it take for Jupiter to make it around the sun? I don't remember, but I think it's like maybe 16 years or something like that. Like for every one of our years, it's slower for them. So the year would be longer. So let's think about if Jupiter has been rotating around the sun, or revolving around the sun, for an infinite number of years. That means it's done it an infinite number of times, right? If it's done it for infinity, it's done it an infinite number of times. But Earth would have done it, let's say, 16 times more than Jupiter would have done it. So what is infinity divided by 16, or times 16? Well, it's infinity. But if something is higher than infinity, then that thing can't be infinity, right? It all of a sudden, it's no longer infinite. That might sound weird to you. Think about it a little bit. As soon as you start actually trying to use the concept of infinity in anything, it all becomes absurdity, because as soon as you subtract one from infinity, what's infinity minus divided by two? It should still be infinity, right? Or what's infinity minus infinity? Well, you would think, well, it's zero. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's still infinity. If you consider the fact that, like, if Earth has done it an infinite number of times and Jupiter's done it an infinite number of times, but Earth has done it an infinite number of times more than Jupiter, it all ends up being nonsense. All of that is to say this: Aquinas didn't believe that true infinites actually exist. And so he gave several arguments to show that there needs to be some start, some beginning point to the things that we see around us. One of those things is motion or movement. If you look around at movement, virtually everything that moves is caused by something that made it move. You can always find a cause to movement, whether it's the wind, whether it's, your body or your parents or whatever. Like, you can always find, well, what caused this to move? 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 And he looked at the world and thought, well, if all movement is caused by some previous movement or some other movement, then what is the very first domino? What's the very first thing that caused movement? It has to be itself something that was unmoved by anything else. He called it the unmoved mover. There's one thing that is unmoved, nothing moved it, yet it can move, and that is what he calls God. Second argument he gave is for causation. Basically, cause and effect. All these are going to be pretty similar. But the idea is not necessarily grounded in movement, but it's grounded in cause and effect. And if you were to trace causes back, this caused this, which caused this, which caused this, which caused this, which caused this, you eventually get back to something that had to have happened without being caused. Something had to start all causes and all effects from that point forward. That he called the uncaused cause. We call that God. There's nothing that caused God, yet all causes stem from him. The uncaused cause. He third gave an argument from contingency, and I think this one's fascinating. The argument from contingency is the idea that everything that exists is contingent upon something else for its existence. Think about you. What do you need in order to exist? Can you exist on your own? No. You needed parents in order for you to even exist. You need oxygen to breathe. You need food to eat. You need water. Like, you need space. You need you can't exist without time and space. So, like, there are things you need in order for you to exist. If you were to look, my Bible right now is on this table. That means my Bible's location is contingent upon the existence of this pulpit. And this right here is its existence or location is contingent upon the existence of this podium. And the podium is contingent upon the building being here. And the building is contingent upon the floor being here, or the ground being here. And the ground being here is contingent upon the earth's existence. So like you can always go further and further back. But there has to be something that all other things found their contingency upon. There has to be some non-contingent being or some non-contingent thing that can exist without needing anything else, because everything else had to have ground in something, and you can't just have an infinite regress back. And so that non-contingent being, the being that exists without needing anything else for its existence, is what Aquinas calls God. Finally, there's an argument from degrees. Basically, we can look at the world around us, and these aren't temperature degrees. These are like moral degrees or goodness degrees. You can rate how good things are. How do you rate how good a pizza tastes? Well, you compare it to other pizzas that you've had before, and you say a scale of 1 to 10. Like, you can rate it, but you have to have something to compare it to in order to rate it. Well, how can you rate how good a moral action is? Well, you have to compare it to other moral actions. But what are you comparing those to? What do you compare goodness to? What he argues is that there has to be some sort of ultimately perfect being by which we get degrees on good and bad and moral and immoral from that point forward. And that, he says, you trace back and it ultimately comes to God. I think Aquinas is a pretty bright guy. And I think that even those arguments, as old as they are, we're talking about 1,000-year-old arguments here, I think they each still carry some weight. The cosmological argument, as it's often presented now, is presented in a number of ways, but one popular way is called the Kalam cosmological argument. There is an apologist named William Lane Craig who makes this a case very well. But in it, it's basically two premises and a conclusion. The first one is this: whatever begins to exist has a cause. That's it seems to be a demonstrably true statement. You don't have things uncaused popping into existence out of nothing. You know, like, things that come, they come because they were caused. Tables exist because tables were built. Humans are alive because humans were born. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. That shouldn't be controversial. Second one is the universe began to exist. And there are a number of reasons that we should believe that the universe began to exist. One of them is the impossibility of the infinite, which we talked about a little bit earlier. But then there are also some scientific reasons to believe that the universe has a beginning. Things generally tend towards chaos and entropy. If the universe had literally existed for an infinite number of years, I mean, infinity past, then there would be no more light. You would not have a working sun anymore. Energy would have been used up. There are things wouldn't exist in the form that they do. I mean, just imagine if our solar system were 100 billion years older, we shouldn't expect it to look as it does now. But if 100 billion years or infinite numbers of billions of years, like, if you really think about what infinity is, there should be no usable energy left. And so all of those reasons are reasons why even today most atheists will believe that the universe had a beginning. It's just the nature of that beginning. But the argument ends by saying this: therefore, the universe has a cause. So whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. It's a fairly simple argument. There's nothing overly controversial in that. But if you think about what that cause has to be, the cause has to be something that can exist outside of the universe. That means it can exist without time and space. It has to be a cause that is extraordinarily powerful in order to cause a universe. I can't cause universes. It has to be more powerful than I am. It has to be very intelligent in order to cause a working universe. And so you can start thinking about the nature of that cause, and that cause we call God. So all of these are cosmological arguments. They are arguments that deal with the existence of things and why things are the way that they are. And each of them, I think, hints strongly and is very suggestive towards the existence of a being beyond ourselves who is responsible for the world around us. Another argument for the existence of God, you have the teleological argument. Teleological doesn't deal with the existence of things, but more the design of things.
things seem to work well. We have a universe that seems to work. We have a solar system you can tell time by. You know, it's kind of interesting. It's like it's predictable, it's ordered, it functions, and there's actual purpose to the function that we can use that benefits us. What is called, and this again, this isn't Christian terminology, this is even just secular science terminology, fine-tuning for life. There are things like the gravitational force around us that if they were altered, there wouldn't be able to be life on this earth. As a matter of fact, the odds of life even existing anywhere in the universe is very, very slim when you consider how many possible types of universes there could be. Like it seems highly unlikely that one would just happen to have all the fine-tuning necessary for life to develop. But ours tends to be that way. Because of that fact, by the way, there are theories that develop about, for example, we are part of a multiverse. Rather than a universe, there's a multiverse with an infinite number of universes that are all slightly different. And so one of them had to end up being like ours. Now, there's no evidence for a multiverse, but what the multiverse does is it helps, if you don't want to believe in God, you say, okay, so it's not just we got lucky, it just we happen to be on the one universe that does permit human life. But I think that belief in God is no less rational than a belief in an infinite number of universes, all slightly different. What people want to do is find any and every reason possible to deny the existence of God, even if you have to put like religious belief into an infinite number of universes to do that. But people talk about the teleological argument by looking at the universe, the solar system, the fine-tuning, the remarkable complexity, order, and function of the world around us, the unlikelihood of life spontaneously generating, or even just like our life itself. You can look at the eye, or you can look at different things. Here's a quote I want to read to you about the existence of protein seems to be, which I like. Again, it's not written by a Christian, but consider these are the types of arguments that the teleological argument gets into. It says, proteins are what you get when you string amino acids together, and we need a lot of them. No one really knows, but there are as many as a million types of protein in the human body, and each one is a little miracle. Again, not written by a believer. By all the laws of probability, proteins shouldn't exist. To make a protein, and this is where he starts getting into the specifics, to make a protein, you need to assemble amino acids, which I'm obliged by long tradition to refer to here as the building blocks of life, in a particular order, in much the same way that you assemble letters in a particular order to spell a word. To make collagen, you need to arrange 1,055 amino acids in precisely the right sequence. But, and here's the obvious but crucial point, you don't make it. It makes itself, spontaneously, without direction. And this is where the unlikelihoods come in. The chances of 1,055 sequence molecule-like collagen spontaneously self-assembling are, frankly, nil. It just isn't going to happen. To grasp what a long shot its existence is, visualize a standard Las Vegas slot machine, but broadened greatly, to about 90 feet to be precise, to accommodate 1,055 spinning wheels instead of the usual three or four, and with 20 symbols on each wheel, one for each of the common amino acids. How long would you have to pull the handle before all 1,055 symbols came up in the right order? Effectively forever. Even if you reduced the number of spinning wheels to 200, the odds would, against all 200 coming up in a prescribed sequence, are 1 in 10 to the 260th. That's a 1 followed by 260 zeros. That in itself is a larger number than all the atoms in the universe. For random events to produce a single protein would seem a stunning improbability, like a whirlwind spinning through a junkyard and leaving behind a fully assembled jumbo jet in the colorful simile of the astronomer Fred Hoyle. Yet, we are talking about several hundred thousand, seems to be some sort of misprint there, types of protein, perhaps a million, each unique and each, as far as we know, vital to the maintenance of a sound and healthy you. Here's the conclusion. even having achieved this. By the way, that's all just for one protein. He says, and you have like a million different types in your body. Even having achieved this, a protein is no good to you if it cannot reproduce itself. And proteins can't. For this, you need DNA. DNA is a whiz at replicating. It can make a copy of itself in seconds, but can do virtually nothing else. So we have a paradoxical situation. Proteins can't exist without DNA, and DNA has no purpose without proteins. Are we to assume then that they arose spontaneously with the purpose of supporting each other? If so, wow. It's a little wonder that we call it the miracle of life. Written by an agnostic in a wonderful book called A Short History of Nearly Everything. But those types of things are what the teleological argument is based on. What are the odds of that type of design happening spontaneously, uncaused, out of nothing, without any thought or purpose behind it? I mean, to believe that is more absurd to believe that there is a mind behind it. I mean, how hard is it to believe that there was some intentionality behind you and behind the way your body works and behind the way the world works and behind the way that the universe and the solar system works? I don't think it's all that unlikely at all. This is from another book by Matt Ridley called Genome. He says, wherever you go in the world, whatever animal, plant, bug, or blob you look at, if it is alive, it will use the same dictionary and know the same code. All life is one. This is talking about the human genome. By the way, the director of the Human Genome Project is a guy named Francis Collins, who wrote a book called The Language of God. He is one of the most famous and well-known scientists alive today. He's Dr. Fauci's boss. He wrote a book called The Language of God. He's someone who believes in God and affirms Christianity. He has a website that he is the director of called BioLogos, which kind of combines some of these ideas. But looking at the human genome, looking at human life, didn't deter him from belief in God. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even a believer until he was working on his PhD from Princeton. He's someone who came to believe in God at a later age because of the things that he was seeing in the world around him. But this passage, or this quote says, the genetic code is the same in every creature, and we all use exactly the same language. And he's talking about your body, using words like dictionary and language. This means, and religious people might find this a useful argument, guys not religious, by the way, that there was only one creation, one single moment when life was born. Again, these are the types of things that the teleological argument is based on, and I think they give you rational justification for your belief in God. But finally, I want to conclude by just thinking briefly about the ramifications of life without God. And this is where I don't think atheists take their worldview seriously. Some deny that there even is a worldview associated with atheism. And maybe that's the case, but that's only the case if you haven't thought long and hard about what it means that there is no God. If you really think about what it means that there is no God, there are some devastating consequences from that. I just two days ago finished the book, The Brothers Karamazov, and it explores in detail some of those ramifications. And it's frightening to consider what the world would be if there was no God. It would be a world without meaning. It would be a world with no intentionality, no purpose, no meaning. It is an accidental world that is a mere blip on the infinite span that exists at one point, goes away at another point, when the universe dies in a heat death, and the universe goes on infinitely with no thought, purpose, meaning behind it, and you are merely an accident. You know what that means? It means you can create some artificial meaning for your life if you want to. Sure, I'm gonna, you know, write a book, or I'm gonna do something. But all of a sudden, what happens? All of the meaning you gave to your life dies with you. There's no purpose to your life beyond getting through it. And that's a dangerous place to be, especially when you recognize that in a world without God, there would be no freedom. And you might not think about this, but free will is something that can only exist if there is a God. The world itself, we call this determinism, the universe itself, it's a deterministic universe. What I mean by that is if a rock falls and it lands, but it doesn't choose to fall and it doesn't pick where it lands. It has no free will. The universe isn't governed by free will. As a matter of fact, when we talk about free will, we're talking about something that would be unique to us. Other things might have, you know, like waves move, wind might blow, but it doesn't choose to. There's no volition behind it. Free will is something that we have, or at least we believe that we have it. But if all of nature is determined without free will, then that means the neurons in your brain have no free will. That means the things that make you you are simply following the laws of nature, and there's no reason to think that you would be the exception, which is one of the reasons why most atheists who have spent time thinking about it deny free will in humans. We see, we respond, we feel, but we don't choose what we feel. We don't get to decide how we respond. Free will is an illusion. You feel like you have free will because you feel like you made a choice. But the idea is you could not have chosen otherwise. You were simply responding to what your brain told you to do. There is no soul. There is no you that tells your body what to do. You are your body. You are a slave to your body. And so whatever the neurons in your brain make you think and you have to do and you have to respond in that way, and ultimately you're a robot. That is the philosophical ramification of you not being unique, of you not being created for a purpose. There's no moral truth in a world without God. What that means is morals, as we see them, are merely things that we have come up with to help us get through life. But that means that we decide our morals. What that means, think about a terrible atrocity. Think about the Holocaust, okay? We all look back on that and we shudder. And we think it was a terrible thing, horribly immoral. But what if, say the war had gone differently? And say Germany was able to either kill every person who disagreed with them or brainwash everyone into agreeing with them so that every single human being alive today was in favor of the Holocaust. Every single person who was alive thought that was a good thing. Does that mean it becomes moral? If every person thinks it and human beings are the ones who determine morality, is there any moral truth above human beings? On atheism, no. There is no moral truth above human beings. During the Nuremberg trials, one of the difficulties was proving a law that was broken by the Nazi soldiers because, I mean, they didn't break German law. They followed German law. They were following orders. They're not under the law of other countries. So how do you punish people for a crime when they didn't commit a crime? And they were told that they broke a higher law that transcends the provincial and the transient. That is, there are some things that it doesn't matter what time you live in, it doesn't matter where you live, they are wrong. They are higher than human beings. If you don't believe in God, there is no higher law. You might live as though there is a higher law, and that's the issue. If you're an atheist, you might live as though there's meaning in your life, but philosophically, logically, there would be none. You might live as though you have freedom, but there would be none. You might live as though there's moral truth and accountability, but if there's no freedom, how do you blame someone for making an immoral decision when they couldn't have chosen otherwise? And that's one of the reasons why there's also no reason or rationality. Some people who pride themselves so much on their reason and rationality in their atheism also don't believe in free will. And that means that all of your beliefs, they're not beliefs that you hold because you have thought things through and researched and chosen a certain belief. They're the beliefs you're forced to have because that's the wiring of your brain. And that means that there's no reason or truth or rationality behind these beliefs. They're merely what you're stuck with. Sam Harris, one of the leading atheists alive in the world today, wrote a book called Free Will, where he discusses some of these ideas. He said, free will is an illusion. Our wills are simply not of our own making. Thoughts and intentions emerge from background causes of which we are unaware and over which we exert no conscious control. We do not have the freedom we think we have. It's like it feels like you have freedom, but you would in fact have no freedom if there is no free will and if there is no God. So what does that mean about how our minds developed? Did our minds develop so that we could be critical, rational people and determine truth? Certainly not. Our minds developed for survival, regardless of truth. Survival of the fittest. That's what our minds are about. C.S. Lewis, I think, makes the point eloquently when he says that if you're an atheist, then you shouldn't even trust your own mind and your own thoughts. He says, supposing there was no intelligence behind the universe, no creative mind, in that case,
Nobody designed my brain for the purpose of thinking. It is merely that when the atoms inside my skull happen for physical or chemical reasons to arrange themselves in a certain way, this gives me, as a byproduct, a sensation that I call thought. But if so, how can I trust my own thinking to be true? He says, it's like upsetting a milk jug and hoping that the way it splashes itself will give you a map of London. But if I can't trust my own thinking, of course I can't trust the arguments leading to atheism, right? If I'm an atheist for what I think is a rational reason, but I can't even trust my own thoughts, then how can I trust my ability to follow those arguments or anything else? Unless I believe in God, I cannot believe in thought. So I can never use thought to disbelieve in God. That's C.S. Lewis, The Case for Christianity. It's an interesting point. I think there's a lot of truth behind it. We'll draw our lesson to a close here in just a moment. But Richard Dawkins, less famous than he used to be. In fact, the whole face of atheism is kind of changing. There was a period where he called the new atheist, the four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse, was Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, and Christopher Hitchens. Those guys were cruel, crass, very anti-religion. I think people have had a little bit of enough of that. Atheism is still out there and alive and well, but it is taking different forms. But Richard Dawkins, I think, does eloquently state the ramifications of life without God. He says, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Do you believe that there's actual good and evil? Most atheists do, but if you do, you're getting that from somewhere. You have to ground that in something. I believe the most rational thing to ground that in is God. When asked, and this is where this type of thinking leads you. I think Richard Dawkins has thought about the ramifications. It's interesting. He'll call things immoral, but at the same time say that there is no morality. But he was asked a sincere question about giving birth to a baby with Down syndrome. You know what his answer was? Abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice. Why does he say that? Well, he was interviewed about that. One reason he said that is he hasn't met any people with Down syndrome. And so he just assumes that they make the overall experience on Earth worse than if they didn't exist. They need to be cared for rather than contributing. And so the world is better without them. If you don't believe in God, that might be the thing to say. I think if you get to know someone with Down syndrome, you realize that that's utter foolishness, that they bring an intense amount of joy to the people in their lives, and their lives are often full of joy. But you read something like that, and that's what atheism, rationally followed, gets you. You must simply pretend that meaning, freedom, moral truth, and reason are realities if you're going to be an atheist, when actuality, they are useful fictions that must be accepted. If you're going to live, you have to live as though these things are true, but you have to just pretend that they're true on atheism. Atheists must believe in these ideas without and against evidence. This is exactly, by the way, what they accuse religious people of doing. They say you believe in God without evidence. Well, you believe that human beings have value without evidence. I mean, what is morality? What is the value of a person if there is no God? They're merely an accident, destined to die anyway. For the atheist, belief in objective morality, human rights and values, significance and meaning are unprovable religious beliefs. If they do hold to those beliefs, they don't hold to them because of their atheism. I saw a tweet that we'll close on a couple days ago, which made me chuckle. This person said, I don't believe in any man-made religious nonsense. I believe in cold scientific facts, like universal human rights and the equality of man. He said that to be funny, but there's truth in that. The idea that if you don't believe in God, yet you believe human beings are all equal, where in the world does that come from? Why would you think that way? Why not think that the person who contributes the most is more valuable than the person who contributes least? And why not get rid of those who are problematic to your existence? Because it leads to things like the Holocaust that you know are immoral. And you know that because God created you to know that. So
So here's the challenge as we bring our lesson to a conclusion. Trust that belief in God is perfectly rational and justifiable, and do not be ashamed to believe. Live as though God lives. Some people are like embarrassed to say that they believe in God because they think it's an irrational claim. Never feel that way. You have plenty of good reasons to believe in God. Subjective, sure. Objective, absolutely. And nobody, or very, very few people, actually can live in this world really as though God does not exist. Because they'll always claim some sort of higher power. They'll always claim some sort of higher morality, some sort of higher meaning, some sort of rationality, some sort of purpose to their life. Even though if there is no God, ultimately there is one. But God loves you. You do have purpose. Sorry I kept you late. Let's end by saying, if there's anyone here who wants to give your life over to God, He loves you. He'd long to have you. If there's anyone here who wants to become a Christian this morning, please let that be known. Come and sit on the front row while we stand and as we sing.